Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. Nicole Alexander is a best-selling author of 11 historical fiction novels, titles that include The Bark Cutters, Sunset Ridge, River Run and The Cedar Tree. Nicole is also a freelance writer whose articles have appeared widely in publications like the Sydney Morning Herald, ABC Online, the Sunday Telegraph and Elle Magazine Australia. The Last Station is Nicole's latest novel. Released by Penguin earlier this year, it's a sweeping saga depicting the harshness of life on the land in 19th century New South Wales, a story set in the dying days of the riverboat trade along the Darling River. Captivating, heartbreaking, but not without humour, I was enthralled by this glimpse into a bygone era, and I'm so delighted to have the chance to speak with Nicole about The Last Station on the podcast today. Welcome, Nicole.
Hey, Claudine. Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Nicole, I'm slightly ashamed to say that whilst I've definitely heard of and seen your novels on shelves before, this is the first opportunity I've had to actually read one. And boy, what an introduction. Historical novels are such a treat for me, but especially those that spotlight Australian history. So on this basis, The Last Station was particularly fascinating. And as I said earlier, a glimpse into riverboat trade on the Darling River. I was wondering if you could tell me what it was that drew you to this era and what sparked this particular story.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I first started thinking about this novel, I really wanted to shine a spotlight, I guess, on a period in Australia's history where you have the vagaries of Mother Nature and the wheels of progress literally combining to ruin people's lives and livelihoods. And there seemed no better time to set the story than in that period leading up to the Great War, which is considered to be Australia's last era of innocence. And also during the time of the demise of the paddle steamer industry, which was so vital in opening up the interior all along the Murray-Darling River system. And I have to say that added to that, I was really interested in exploring, the trajectory of a family that goes from absolute wealth and power to poverty in a span of only 20 years and how that affects each member of the family across two generations.
Absolutely fascinating. Was there a particular spark of inspiration?
Well, there was a couple of things, actually. We've been on the land, our family were on the land from 1893 to 2020. So we only just recently sold our last property. So we were located northwest of New South Wales, quite close to the Queensland border, north of Moree. And when my great-grandfather first selected our property in 1893, it was the same year that Captain White steamed up past Bourke, then up through to the town of Mungindi, which is just west of us, in a vessel called the Brewarrina. So at the time, my great-grandfather was only about, 50 kilometres away, I suppose. And at the time, Captain White talked about exploring further east, that he thought how wonderful it would be if he could take his vessels further along from the Darling, then into the Barwon River, which Darling goes straight into the Barwon, and then across up and into the border town of Gundawindi. So that's Gundawindi is located on the New South Wales-Queensland border. If he had actually succeeded in doing that, his vessel would have gone through one of our properties at the time. And that really got me thinking about the paddle steamer history in our era and its demise, how it began and how it improved life for so many people living in the interior, particularly in Western New South Wales where the story is concentrated. So that sort of was that little spark that got me interested in writing about it. Captain White didn't end up going that far because the Barwon, unfortunately, the river becomes very narrow and it's full of snags, etc. So it was never going to be navigational, unfortunately. But that was one of the things that really got me interested in writing about it.
As always with historical novels, I managed to learn something about Australia that I didn't know or fully appreciate beforehand. So I was wondering, Nicole, if you could tell me about the Great Flood of 1890 and its impact on pastoralists.
Yeah, so it was a major catastrophic event, and it made not only national news but international news. And that's because in the 1890s, Bourke, believe it or not, was the largest inland port for wool in the world, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it. So you have all these bales of wool being funneled into the port of Bourke, as it was known, and then going downstream to be sold at market over the border in South Australia. So, of course, from an international perspective, wool buyers, textile mills in the UK were like, what? The port of Bourke's going to be wiped off the face of the earth. And indeed, the townsfolk did a mighty job trying to build a huge levee around the port of Bourke to try and sort of, you know, contain the town to varying degrees of success, but obviously a lot of damage was sustained. But the effects of that flood lasted for a good decade afterwards, because obviously the amount of water, which we're used to seeing, unfortunately, in Australia, particularly since the beginning of the year, really decimated the area. Stock losses report from that time put the sheep losses at nearly 500,000 and 900 head of cattle and sheep. But it's the human stories, I think, that resonate so profoundly down through the decades to where we are now, because once again, we have stories of people caught in trees on rooftops. I read one account of a family of four living in a tree for 8 days until the waters recited, and they actually existed on raw sheep meat and a pot of cold tea. So it was really quite extraordinary. So that did have long-ranging implications for the greater district of the Western Division, which, as I said, is where the story is predominantly set. And then from there on in, of course, on either side of the Great Flood in 1890, we have things like, you know, the continuous droughts that are occurring in Australia. We have rising and falling commodity prices. And we also have this almost changing of the guard in regards to some of the great pastoral stations of the period, where we see them dwindling in size, some being repossessed by banks and others being bought out by corporates, because this is a period where we have corporations realising that they need to get a foothold in agriculture in the bush, because there's so much money to be made from wool during that period.
For this story, the Great Floods kind of signalled the beginning of the end for the Dalhunties, didn't it?
It is, absolutely. I mean, there's the Dalhunty family. We have a family that had so much wealth and power that they were literally at the pinnacle of society. And then sort of from after the Great Flood, when we meet them in 1909 in the story, they're literally on, well, they are, they're on the brink of ruin. They've had some dreadful weather conditions that have gone against them. First of all, the flood, then the Federation drought, which lasted from 1895 to 1902. And actually during that time, there was hardly any water in the Darling River at all, because there was no rainfall and nothing further north in the catchments to come down from Queensland or either from the east in New South Wales itself. So they really are in dire straits. But the patriarch of the family, Ben Dalhunty, he's a quirky individual. He's made some unusual decisions. And even though the family made their wealth from wool and they've lost the majority of their money now, he's actually decided that, okay, well, yes, they may live quite close to the largest inland port for wool in the world, but they're not going to actually produce wool anymore. Let's sell all the sheep and let's grow vegetables instead. So it's Ben's quirky personality to a certain extent that's also helped exacerbate their slide into decline.
It was a lovely introduction to the patriarch of the family, but can you tell us a little bit more about the story?
Yes, so Ben Dalhunty is a very quirky individual. His forefathers were consummate hoarders, not unlike my own family, I have to admit. And because of that, he actually has all his ancestors' hand-me-down clothes to wear. So during the Great Flood, they're actually stored in an attic in the homestead. So all those clothes were saved. Unfortunately, his dear wife, Rachel, her beautiful silk gowns, et cetera, she was not so fortunate. But Ben has a lot of clothes to draw on. So it's not unusual for him to walk out the back door in the morning, dressed for work, wearing a top hat, perhaps a gold-headed walking cane, trousers that are too big in the waist and too short in the leg. And as I said, he is quite a quirky individual. So he does quite enjoyed lying in the vegetable patch, talking to his vegetables, explaining to them the significance of where they fit into his vegetables growing scheme, etc. And he has that same relationship with his chickens to a certain extent. So with the chickens, the Dalhunties have been generational breeders of chickens. So they're serious fowl people, basically. And for Ben, that's sort of a link for him as well to the past, because apart from his wife, Rachel, he's the only one in the family that really remembers the glory days of when they employed 80-plus people, et cetera, and they wanted for nothing. So the chickens are one of those links to the past for him as well. The interesting thing, I think, about Ben is that because of his disposition, he can see that the family structure is probably not as solid as it used to be. He has three children. So we have two girls and a boy, and Julian is the eldest, and he's quite a sensitive lad, frustrated with his father's decision-making. Then we have Laura, the middle child, who's definitely more like her city-bred mother, more refined and hopeful of once again sort of, you know, enjoying the finer things in life. She's very good at needlework, etc. And then we have the youngest, Meg, who's a bit of a tomboy. She's quite a feisty individual who's really been brought up, you know, she's had to bring up herself to a certain extent, and she's very close to her older brother, Julian. And that is because, and I'm not giving away anything in saying this for readers, they have lost another member of the family. So the youngest child, Davey, has died 12, 18 months earlier in the story due to an accident. And as far as the parents are concerned, Ben and Rachel, that becomes the catalyst for Rachel's dissatisfaction with her husband. And in the story, she receives a telegram and she has to visit a relative in Sydney, and she's away for an inordinately long length of time. While she's away, we really see that she was sort of the one that, to a certain extent, kept her husband grounded. Because as soon as she leaves, Ben's personality becomes a little more disassociated from reality. He finds it very hard to carry on in her absence. And in turn, his children suffer from that. When she does return, she brings a young man with her, unannounced, that she's met at one of the department stores in Sydney, and his name is Ethan Harris. And Ethan's arrival immediately sets the three Dalhunty children at odds, because they literally do see him as a replacement for their dead younger brother. So Ethan is the catalyst for a lot of dissent and dissatisfaction in the family because of that.
So much to unpack in this story, and I think I could sit here and chat to you all day about it. As you were talking, I was thinking about this. The Great Flood really seemed to signal the beginning of the end for the Dalhunties, and their name was associated with prosperity and prestige in 19th century New South Wales. But I think, and you hit the nail on the head when you said that Ben was such a quirky character, but I think more than that, I think much of the decline of their wealth and their status as a family could be attributed to poor management and his like complete eccentricities. It seemed not to understand how his decisions were affecting not only the property but his family. I found him more than eccentric. I found him to be such a flawed character.
Yeah, well, that's right. I think the thing is that when I was crafting him, I was trying to work out, was he always like that? Because at the very beginning of the novel, we see him wearing a purple necktie and having a conversation with someone who features a character who features prominently later on in the work, Captain Ashby. And you sort of think, was he always like that? Or has the Great Flood and the droughts and him not being quite capable of taking over the reins of running the property after his own father passed on, has that also exacerbated what was already there? So I think that was a question that was always in the back of my mind. Was he born that way, or did the situation make him that way, or was it a combination of both? So I think, you know, I took the view during the crafting that it had to be a combination of both. But we also have in his makeup, I guess, after the death of his youngest son, Davey, guilt as well, which probably makes his decision-making a little bit more fractured to a certain extent, because Rachel blames him for the child's death without giving too much away to the reader. And I think that sort of worsens his ability to make, as far as logical decision making is made as well.
As you said earlier, the arrival of Ethan Harris into the Dalhuntie clan really does set the Dalhuntie children off in many ways. And I think what fascinated me the most about this was the depiction of a family in crisis at that point in time. I mean, there was grief, there was lack of money, there was lack of direction and motivation, and it really set them down a treacherous path, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the thing about Ethan is that he's an opportunist. As I said, Rachel meets him in a department store. He's willing, he's personable. He's street smart enough, despite a very, very ordinary start to life, to realise when he's onto a good thing. And he's led to believe that he's being taken in by this woman who comes from this, you know, staggeringly wealthy family that's so well known in rural Australia that he'd just be an idiot not to accept the offer, like, come home, live with us, sort of thing. When he gets there, the realisation that he's living in a land of poverty and everyone, including the children, have sort of given up on their future there, it stuns him, because what Ethan does do is bring to the reader, I guess, a fresh pair of eyes. What could be done on the property, what the family haven't managed to do, as you said, because of Ben's attitude, because of his difficulties. And he opens up a whole new world to the readers as far as the possibilities of the property, but then at the same time, he causes so much dissent amongst the other family members. He can't but help do it, because Ben, because he still has this difficult relationship with his wife, Rachel. Rachel suddenly come home after such a long absence. He's overjoyed at seeing her. He goes overboard in terms of being friendly to Ethan, treating him as if he is another son, and that automatically disenfranchises Ethan from the other Dalhuntie children. They just can't understand what their mother's done, why Ethan is there, why their father is so taken with him, because Ethan, of course, is a natural and can do everything. So he can do no wrong. He can even, you know, he rides perfectly. Everything he does well, and he never complains until he starts to realise that, you know, he's never going to be accepted and he's made a mighty mistake, so he has to leave.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, Ethan was such a fascinating character. Was he based on a real-life person?
Yes, he is. So I did mention that my family are great hoarders. So we have old station diaries and paddock books and mail order catalogues and magazines and things like that from the 1890s. The majority of the collection goes through to about the 1950s. We also have these wonderful oral stories that have been passed down through the generations. Now, as we all know with family stories, Claudine, they get a bit fluid at times, don't they?
They certainly do.
You know, we were around a bit, but there's always that kernel of truth at the top of the tree, so to speak. So when I was crafting Ethan's character, I was reminded of a story from my family. My great-grandmother, when she was widowed, she used to spend her summer holidays in the Blue Mountains near Sydney. So she would leave our property. She would trundle the 50 kilometres by dray to the closest rail siding at the time, which was a little town called Garrah. From there, the train would take her down through Moree all the way down through to Sydney Central Station. Then she'd go up to Blue Mountains. So she used to stay with friends in the Blue Mountains, and she was there for a couple of years. And she always made a trip to Anthony Horden's department store in Sydney to do her shopping. While she was there over a couple of years, she made friends with a young man by the name of Billy De Silva. Billy De Silva himself came from a loving family, one of pioneering stock from the north coast of New South Wales. But my great-grandmother actually offered him a home and a job. So at the end of one of her holidays, she came back to the property unannounced with Billy in tow. Now, the interesting thing about this is that she didn't tell anybody in the family what her plans were, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it, when it's the early, you know, 1900s. And, of course, we have no idea what her four sons thought at the time. I have a pretty good idea of what their opinions would have been. Obviously, it would have been a shock for them. But the interesting thing was is that Billy became an integral member of the family to the extent that when my own grandfather, my paternal grandfather, went and fought on the Western Front during the Great War, Billy was integral in helping to keep the property going at that time. So we were sheep producers back then. So we were supplying wool, like every other property across Australia, to the UK, textiles, obviously, to make uniforms. So it was important that, you know, everybody do their bit for king and country. So he was very much at the forefront of doing that. And he actually stayed with the family on and off for 20 years. And even after my great-grandmother passed away, he stayed in the district before he then moved further afield to work. So Billy was a natural at everything he did. He could ride a horse like nobody's business. He could blade shear a sheep in record time, which was very important at the turn of the century to be able to do things like that.
Yep.
And in fact, he killed a death adder, which is a snake, at the back gate of our property by cracking it like a whip to break its neck. I know. Gory, isn't it?
Oh, that's horrific.
And it was actually placed in a jar of methylated spirits and kept in the station laundry for 80 years until it was eventually, you know, decayed and was thrown out. So I did tell you we were hoarders. So I took that real life story of Billy, family legend, and from that conjured Ethan from the ashes, so to speak. But obviously for the purpose of the narrative, I had to, you know, change it somewhat and ensure that compared to Billy, Ethan was not so warmly welcomed into the Dalhunty clan.
I must say that my sympathies lay with Julian as the eldest son in this book and the frustration that he felt, not only with his father, but also, you know, the fact that his mother just returned, you know, from a very lengthy absence from the family. And not only did she return, but she returned with Ethan in tow. I felt his frustration very keenly. So I wondered, Nicole, how did you get inside his head?
Well, I considered the viewpoint of a young man who was already extremely frustrated with the situation and his father's decision-making. And Julian knows that his father doesn't think properly. He knows, he's well aware of the tangents that his father goes off on. So because of that, to a certain extent, he clearly sees his father's flaws. And that's probably, you know, I'd consider that to be a weight for a young man to carry on his shoulders to start off with. And then to see his mother leave, desert them, and see his sister working like a navvy to keep the household going in her absence, to see his father literally fall apart over the months his mother's away, and then for her to return dressed in her finery, having spent a lot of the family's money, which they could ill afford, to sort of, you know, have spent on frivolous luxuries down in Sydney while she's away. It just would have been absolute disappointment for Julian. So as you say, he's frustrated with his father, but so disappointed in his mother. And that disappointment and frustration becomes, to a certain extent, anger as well, because he knows for him to live his life, he has to leave, he has to get out. But his loyalty is such, as the eldest son, there's never the right time for him to leave. There's always something that's going on. And the person that's holding him, tethering him the most to the property, is his younger sister Meg, because she just idolises him. And to a certain extent, he does her as well. So it's a really close sibling relationship that he comes to realise probably means more to him than anything else, to a certain extent.
Rachel was an intriguing character, to say the least, a woman who had clearly suffered a great many losses and grieved the loss of her son, but one who was also so easily able to leave her family behind for a lengthy period without even the slightest concern for how they might fare without her. And as we said, her absence was so keenly felt not only by her children, but her husband. Was this something you especially wanted to explore in the context of this story?
I wanted to show a woman who'd actually had been told by her father that if she married Ben Dalhunty, she was marrying wealth. She would, you know, that was a social pinnacle. She would want for nothing. It was a great marriage. The interesting thing about it, even though it was a sort of, you know, society match, it was also a love match to a certain extent. They really adored each other when they first met, and they still do during the course of the story. The love is still there. But she was used to certain standards. She lived in Sydney. She was used to entertaining, to domestic staff, etc. All those extra luxuries that come with being moneyed. And certainly she might have gone to have lived in the middle of nowhere, but she wanted for nothing as far as, you know, clothes, jewelry, domestics, big homestead, etc. It was all there. To lose it, and to lose it so suddenly through a major flooding event, I considered she would still be suffering the trauma from that. Do you ever get over an event like that? Probably not. I know my own family during the 1976 flood, we lost 15,000 head of sheep in that flood.
Wow.
We were on the property. We were marooned by water. We had helicopter drops for food, etc., on the dam bank. I was only, 10 at the time. There was a lot going on then. And I, you know, at times I still think of that. I do draw on that when I'm thinking about people's experience in, you know, difficult natural disasters. So, yes, I don't think in Rachel's case, in the last station, that she ever got over that event. And then, of course, life becomes more of a struggle. Then she actually loses her son, and she really does blame her husband for the death of her child. I think when she leaves to go to Sydney, it's the escape that she needs to take before she literally has some type of breakdown. I think when she leaves, she always knows she's going to come back. That's in the back of her mind. She knows that she has to come back. There's really nowhere else for her to go. You know, there's no money. It's not like she could, you know, ask for a portion and abscond, and it wouldn't have been accepted in that day and age anyway, unless she was supremely wealthy. So she always knew she had to come back. And she knew that she needed things to change. And I think when she meets Ethan in the department store and he's such a personable young man, she thinks, yes, you know, we need this breath of fresh air. And I also had in the back of my mind that she was guiltily aware of having been away for so long. So bringing Ethan with her was almost a little bit of security for her fronting the family again.
So the family that she came back to wasn't the same family that she left. I mean, the children, I think, when we call them children, I mean, Julian was an adult and, you know, Laura not far behind him. And I think that they looked at their mother with different eyes when she came back.
Absolutely. I think the thing that is probably very telling in the story is when she actually comes back to the homestead, and the next morning she's got these trunks of clothes because she's been sort of without for a decade or so. So she's taken what she could. She sort of cleared out family mementos, which were rightfully hers because from her side of the family, but she's very proud of that. But she also takes things from the pantry of the house that she stays in Sydney as well. So it's almost like, you know, bringing back a touch of Sydney. So she just has those, you know, a few fleeting moments of what her escape meant to her. And I think that for Julian, all those things add up to the fact that she was away for so long. Yes, possessions had to be organised to be returned to the station, such as furniture, etc. But she was purposely extending her stay. And he takes the view that if there had been somewhere for her to stay in Sydney, she wouldn't have stayed. She may not have come back. And I guess that's a question for the reader. And I wanted it to be so. Would she have stayed if she'd had the opportunity to stay or not? Because certainly the children feel that by deserting them and bringing a stranger into their home, she's not the mother that they knew before she left.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, Nicole, a book of this nature and the detail in it requires a fair amount of research. Did you uncover anything surprising in your research?
Yes, well, some interesting things, actually. One was regarding the Afghan cameleers. So, I mean, they really don't feature a lot in the work itself except for comments, I guess, here and there in the narrative. But we all know how important cameleers were in terms of opening up trade and communication, exploration, etc., into the interior. And there was a Gantown on the edge of Bourke, and the cameleers that lived there were really vital, obviously, to the community and the greater community and going further west. But during the Federation drought, which was 1895 to 1902, there was no water in the Darling, so the paddle steamers really were hardly running at all. But the railway line had started up, thanks to the New South Wales government. So the townspeople and the people in remoter areas really were reliant on the cameleers to get their goods to and fro to the railhead. And so because of that, you would think that people would be extraordinarily grateful and also respectful of the cameleers and what they contributed in that area, in the Western Division. But in fact, in a lot of cases, they weren't. And this was due to some laws that were introduced by differing states across Australia. For example, in Western Australia, they had a law that said that Afghans could not mine gold. And we know how big the gold boom was in WA. Well, they were literally cut out from physically mining gold over there. And all these different laws culminated in the 1901 Immigration Act, which stopped Afghans from returning to Australia if they'd been abroad. Now, a lot of people don't realise that the Afghans were really savvy businessmen. I mean, apart from the businesses they had in Australia, they were travelling home quite a lot to visit family and tend to other businesses abroad as well. So if you'd been on a boat after that act came in 1901, you wouldn't have gotten any further than the docks unless you'd had sponsorship. You effectively needed a visa to be allowed entry back into the country. Now, the negativity towards the Afghans, apart from the government regulations that were number one, I guess, was also people felt challenged by the Afghans themselves. They didn't like their appearance, their clothes. They didn't understand their religion. So they were Muslim and Sikh. And the white Teamsters really disliked them because they were so good at their job. They were so effective. So I actually read accounts of the Afghans being tossed off the Burke Bridge at the turn of the century because of that animosity.
Wow.
And I think that's mentioned during the narrative as well. On a lighter note, a couple of the other things I learned about with taxidermy. Now, we have Miss Odene Carlisle, who's one of the characters in The Last Station, who becomes an attachment for Julian in the story. And Miss Carlisle is quite adept at taxidermy. And I knew that, we all know during the Victorian age that taxidermy was a big thing, but I knew that it had been done, you know, women were quite involved in it, different parts of Australia, but I'd never actually read specific accounts of taxidermy being undertaken by women in the middle of nowhere in the Western Division of New South Wales.
Yeah.
So I did read an account in an old family history from the area of a woman, you know, grazier's wife, actually trying her hand at taxidermy. So she had made makeshift tools based on a kit she'd seen in a mail order catalogue. And from there, she had taught herself the art of curing skins and stuffing and mounting her specimens. Now, you can only imagine the smelly disasters that probably would have happened when you have someone trying to teach themselves the art of curing, stuffing and mounting an animal for decoration in your home when you're living, your home is in the middle of a paddock. Back then, you can imagine the rodents that would have come in.
Yes.
So that was one thing. So when I read that, I wanted Odene Carlisle to sort of, you know, have that tangent towards the taxidermy side of things. And the other thing as well is fishscale embroidery. So fishscale embroidery, is a fascinating thing. So I'd seen samples of work from the turn of the century from Victoria, you know, cooler environment. So I never dreamt it was actually done in Western Division of New South Wales as well. It was in Queensland.
Yeah.
So women would actually use the scales from fish to imitate petals on flowers and feathers on birds. And they preferred perch because perch actually have, well, the variety they used back then had iridescent scales. So when they're on needlework, they'd shimmer in the light.
Amazing.
So they'd catch the fish and they'd scale them and then they'd steep the scales in water, cold water for a couple of days, and that would make the scales pliable. And then they'd actually pierce with a hot needle, and gee, you'd need good eyesight for this, two small holes in the larger portion of the scale, and then they would use that to stitch the scale onto their needlework. So they'd make, you know, decorative runners for tables, they'd use it for edging for different things for wall hangings. Some of that needlework actually had quite a fan base further south in Victoria. And I read this account of a matron having high tea in a drawing room in, I think it was Melbourne or Adelaide, can't remember offhand now, and ooing and ahhing to her friends about the latest acquisition of fishscale needlework she'd obtained from the wilds of the interior.
Absolutely fascinating. I had no idea that was a thing.
It was a big thing.
Indeed it was. Now, the other thing that I found fascinating in this story, and I think I read that it was based on a real event, was the Jeffersons, the family called the Jeffersons in the book, and the paddle steamer that they inhabited. That was a real thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So in 1921, the paddle steamer Wave became marooned during the 1921 flood near Bourke. And the owner of the vessel, from what I can gather, was absolutely shocked by this occurrence. He kept on going back and forth, wondering how he could actually get the steamer back into the Darling, which, of course, he couldn't. And during my research trip out to Bourke and that area, I struck up conversation, which is part of my across the locals when I go out and do research. I struck up conversation with a lady in one of the clubs in Bourke one evening, told her what I was doing, et cetera, et cetera. So we started talking about the PS Wave, and she said to me, and I'd already written the chapter, so this is sort of just getting some extra colour for that section, basically. So I knew that the PS Wave had been grounded, as I just mentioned, and that it had stayed there, basically, because it couldn't be moved back in. And this into the water, and this lady said to me, Nicole, do you know that the captain went back there like for months on end, and he'd walk around the vessel and he'd say to his friends, how am I to get back into the water? It's an impossibility. All his money was tied up in that vessel.
Yeah.
So one day he walked around the vessel three times with a friend. He kicked the hull of the boat and he said to himself, I know, I'll move the family in. So he did. So he moved his wife and the children in, and that gave me this wonderful image of her children climbing all up and down, you know, the side of this grounded steamer, and chickens squawking and flapping around and washing, hanging on a makeshift line, etc. The interesting thing about it is this lady was telling me that, you know, because the family lived there for almost a couple of decades, I believe, that became known locally as Noah's Ark.
Loved that.
Which is great. But, you know, the stories of steamers, part of my research, obviously I've read a lot. I had to read a lot for this book. I read a maritime archaeological survey on steamer wrecks in the Darling, which gave me this wonderful insight into all the terrible things that could actually happen to steamers when they were plying up and down the waterways. And one of them was trying to keep the pressure on the boilers at a constant temperature, because the steamers needed a huge amount of timber to keep the paddle steamers going. But the pressure gauges were quite, you know, finely tuned, so you needed a really conscientious engineer to keep abreast of the pressure so you didn't have a problem. Yeah. So you do have accounts of boilers blowing up and some ending up in trees, etc. Other stories where boats have hit sandbars and been marooned, or they've hit a snag. It's a big snag in a river could punch up big hole in the hull of a boat and do serious damage, if not sink it. So you have all these different things happening to these steamers, which of course were such a vital component to the opening up of the interior along the Murray-Darling River. And the industry really only started through need. So when gold was discovered at Orange in 1851, all the teamsters and their drays that would have normally serviced, you know, sort of remote towns and stations, etc., were drawn to the lucrative goldfields market because so much money could be made and was a much faster turnaround for them as well. Mm. So as more gold was discovered, these remote stations and inland towns were literally forgotten about. So it became a really dire need to find another means of transportation to get goods in and out of the Western Division and, of course, other parts of New South Wales, Victoria. So that's when we have a group of men who realise that those major rivers, so the Murray, the Murrumbidgee and the Darling, could become the new inland highways, literally. So that's how the steamer industry began, which is really fascinating. And then it literally ended because the New South Wales government took one look at the amount of bales being sold in South Australia, and they did not want the proceeds from their state-grown produce to benefit another state.
Yeah.
So where previously there'd been no railways going into the interior, suddenly we see a railway line opened up between Bourke and Sydney in, I think it was 1885, and the government offers all these incentives, freight subsidies, etc. So that takes wool away from the steamers and graziers, start putting their, you know, wool on the trains. And then we have, you know, the drought that once again impacts the steamers and weirs and locks as well, that the government promised to build to make the Darling more navigationable, basically. They came to nothing. And by the time you get to the Great War in 1914, you've got more and more men leaving at the area, New South Wales, the whole of Australia, to fight for king and country. That's literally the end of the paddle steamer days in that end of the system.
Okay, so if there was one thing that you would like readers to take away from this novel, Nicole, what would it be?
Wow, that's a big question, Courtney. She's got me there. I guess heritage, perhaps, which is one of the major themes in the story, if we're looking from a thematic angle, because I was really interested in exploring the meaning and the loss of heritage.
Yeah.
Well, can you lose your heritage as well? So, you know, heritage is all of our inherited traditions, monuments and objects and family and culture and all the meanings and behaviours we draw from there.
Yeah.
So, you know, in The Last Station, we see a family that's had this glorious past that's now lost their standing in society, the majority of their business, the majority of their land, many of their material objects, which prior to the Great Flood were beautiful, you know, pieces. So they're literally standing on the fringes of society compared to where they were 20 years prior. But the patriarch, Ben Dalhunty, doesn't really understand. He appreciates what his ancestors have achieved and what they did in the past, but he doesn't take responsibility nor appreciate how he's led them to where they are now in their current time. He tends to see heritage as a very fluid thing that's always morphing and changing with each year, each passing year. So past goes into the present, whereas his son Julian, when you look at the difference in the generational viewpoints, doesn't remember the glory days. So because of that, he's very frustrated and angry at his father. He only knows the past, the nostalgia of his father. So that causes a lot of angst. So that's the subtext in the story. So that heritage and the question of heritage becomes one of the central pillars of conflict in the novel for all the members of the family.
Yeah.
Even feisty young Meg, when they find themselves in the middle of nowhere on the adventure of a lifetime, She just wants to go home because she recognises the value of what they have, even though to a certain extent it's not much at all.
Nicole, you might know that there are a lot of writers who listen to this podcast, and based on your, you know, exceptional and incredible publishing career to date, I wondered if you had any advice that you could offer to aspiring authors out there.
I have to say, number one thing is discipline for me. I think you really do have, I'm a very disciplined writer, so I sit down at 8:39 in the morning. I only have short breaks, and then I finish about 3:30, 4 o'clock. When I finish, I get out and I do something physical. So I'm a great believer in active body, active mind. So feeding, you know, the inner self, the outer self, the whole lot. My sister's an expert on that type of stuff, Brooke. But, yeah, so that's number one, the discipline is required. The other thing is, and even though it's difficult if you're someone who's interested in writing historical fiction and you're doing your own research anyway, is you do have to read widely and read a lot, because that really does help you learn. I mean, I have a master's degree and certainly that was of some assistance, but it's been my wider reading and continually reading different genres all the time that I think has assisted me the most. And the other thing that's helped me with my writing as far as sentence construction and word choice is reading poetry. I found that extremely helpful. And I also tend to listen to music. If I have a writer's block in the morning and I find it a little bit difficult to get started, I'll listen to music for 10 or 15 minutes. That's after I've meditated. I do meditate every morning as well to get that clear mind before I begin. Do tend to go off on tangents, so I've got to make sure that I'm grounded when I write as well, so I get that sense of structure. I don't plan A to Z. I tend to plan the first few chapters, and then after that, I tend to take the view that the story has to be authentic, how life can take over, which is certainly something that happened in The Last Station about halfway through. I wanted to see how characters' lives can change like that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that. If listeners wanted to learn more about you and your books, where can they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm on Facebook under Nicole Alexander. So I've got my normal personal page and then I've got my author page. So I tend to do a lot of historical blogs once a week. I do historical blogs on that. And then I have my website, which is nicolealexander.com.au. I'm on Instagram as well. I've been a bit tardy with Instagram the last month or so. I started off with Facebook when I first started writing, so that's a while ago now, and I think Facebook is just a medium that, before these other ones came into play, is one that I can relate to, because, you know, it allows you to be a little bit more wordy, and I'm a wordy person.
Oh, That's fantastic. Nicole, I wanted to say that I truly enjoyed The Last Station and the glimpse it offered into Australia's pastoral history. An absolutely fabulous read that I recommend to all my listeners. Thank you so very much for joining me on Talking Aussie Books this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Claudine. It's been a pleasure.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetinellis.com, via Instagram, Facebook or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!